Hey everyone, I'm Dr. Terry, and this is the Love Doctor program on Empower Radio, the show that gives you the facts about relationships and love. Now, I've been helping individuals and couples improve their relationships for the past 30 years, and today I'm here to give you science-based strategies for your relationships and those of your children. Welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Terry, and thanks for listening. Now, I have a wonderful program for you today. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink, sit back and enjoy. Because in today's program, I'll be talking to Peggy Ornstein about her latest New York Times bestselling book, Girls and Sex. It's a great book, a great read. I highly recommend that everyone read it. Now, Peggy spoke with more than 70 young women between the ages of 15 and 20 about their attitudes and early experiences with physical intimacy. And she says that there's a generation gap that has emerged between parents and their girls. The mothers and fathers of tomorrow's women have little idea what their daughters are up to sexually or how they feel about it. Now, Peggy is the author of 5 books. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and has also written for such publications as the New York Times, USA Today, Vogue, Time, and The New Yorker. She's also contributed commentaries to NPR's All Things Considered and the PBS NewsHour. In 2012, Peggy Ornstein was named one of 40 women who changed the media business in the past 40 years. Peggy is a graduate of Oberlin College in Ohio and lives in Berkeley, California with her husband and their daughter, Daisy. Now, besides being an esteemed journalist and best-selling author, she also grew up in my hometown, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Yay! We even went to the same youth group together. Now, I should probably say that I'm older than Peggy, so I actually hung out with her older brothers, John and David. Peggy was the baby in the family, and she hung out with my brother. But I vividly remember Peggy. She had the best, coolest, curliest blonde hair around. And I was so envious of her hair. Like, I literally remember thinking, why can't my hair do that? And I have this picture of her in my mind, walking down the hall, smiling, almost on the tips of her toes, bopping down the hall with lots of energy and lots of enthusiasm. And it's funny because her brothers, as I remember them, were a bit more reserved or quiet. So Peggy was more social, more energy, and more smiles all the way around. And to me, she looks exactly the same today, listeners. So if you look online, it's that same blonde, curly, great hair. And it seems like she hasn't aged a bit. How is that so? So welcome to the program, Peggy. Great to have you today.
Photoshop, baby.
Photoshop. Okay, that's it. I get it. Got to remember it. And what do you think of my memories of you when we were growing up? Do you remember having all that energy?
No. I know. Yes. I am definitely more out there than my brothers, for sure. But and I didn't feel I had much control over my hair back then. I do have really, I mean, you know, make it a love fest. I have such wonderful memories of you, Terry. And the irony is that I wanted your straight blonde hair more than anything.
Don't we always want what we don't have, Peggy?
But, you know, I have the two memories I have are, first of all, you wouldn't remember, but your family came over to my family's house for dinner once, and you were a vegetarian, and you had read Diet for a Small Planet. Uh-huh. And you told me all about it, and I was so impressed, plus I so looked up to you, that I became a vegetarian for the next 14 years.
Wow, so, I didn't know that, Peggy. Yeah. That's so nice.
Yeah.
Yes, I do remember coming over your house, and I remember giving the whole explanation. It takes 10 pounds of grain to feed a cow, to get 1 pound of meat. I remember that whole spiel, yes.
Yeah. And so that made a huge impact on me. And then, of course, you were Glinda.
Oh, yes. The Good Witch and the Wizard of Oz. come out, wherever you are,
perfect
and meet
casting.
The young lady. Yes.
But you were always the, like, the older girl, or the older person, the slightly older teenager who was really nice to the younger kids, as opposed to the ones who weren't, you know, who were kind of mean or sort of high-handed. I always had such great affection and looked up to you so much. So,
oh, thank you. I appreciate that, Peggy. And back at you, because I have such fond memories of you and, of course, your whole family as well.
And you know that your younger sister and my oldest sister-in-law are very close friends.
Yes, I know that in Minneapolis.
And our nieces are all good friends.
Isn't that fun? Now, do you get to get back to Minneapolis often?
I do. I go back every few months. But now all the kids have, you know, they're all adults, so they've all moved.
Right,
none of them are there anymore.
Right. I still go back too, though, often. I would love to even still live there in some dreamland in the future.
Yeah.
Perhaps, right?
Maybe when global warming has gotten a little more so that it's not so cold in the winter.
Yes, I agree. Well, of course, you're in California. So what inspired you to go from Minneapolis to Berkeley and become a journalist?
Berkeley was sort of the end point. I went to New York for some years first, but, you know, I wanted to be a journalist from the time I was in 10th grade. I took a journalism class the first quarter of my 10th grade year because a friend of mine was taking it. And, you know, I have a book of essays that's coming out at the end of February, essays and reported pieces that I've written on women and girls. And in the introduction to that, I talk about this story of being asked by my high school guidance counselor to do a story on teen mothers in our school. And, you know, I went to St. Louis Park High School, which was not a school where I thought there would be teen mothers, frankly. But it was a very economically diverse school, and it had a broad spectrum of types of kids. And not everybody was college bound, et cetera, et cetera. So I met this girl in a classroom, and empty classroom. And she told me her story, and, you know, she had a 2-year-old, and it was very hard, and she didn't really have friends, and she nobody in the school knew she had this child. And I took the story. I said, I won't use your real name, won't tell anybody your real name. She got up and she started to walk out, and she turned around and she said, "But if you see me in the hallway, please don't say hi to me, because there's no reason that somebody like you would know somebody like me, and I don't want anybody asking any questions." Right. And I just,
that is so powerful.
I know. And I really think that was the moment. I really think I thought, you know, that part of me, you know, I mean, I was a kid, so I couldn't quite put it, this kind of metaphor on it, but, or analysis on it. But, you know, it was, I realized that it wasn't just like the perils of teen sex. This was about two girls who, you know, by choice and chance, had really different experiences and really different options in kind of the new age of what it meant to be a woman. Because of class, because of stigma, because of all kinds of things. And I realized the power of individuals to tell the universal story, I think, at that time.
Right, to write about others. But, you know, interestingly enough, Peggy, I mean, most of your books, and you're saying these essays that are coming out as well are personal in nature. They're about your experiences, your family, your daughter, and you're so forthcoming in your books about you as well and your experiences with whatever you're telling. Is that true that your own personal experiences motivate what you write about?
Yeah, I mean, either I have personal, I mean, I really write about the you know, the way we, when I was writing a kind of periodic column for the Times for a while that was called The Way We Live Now. And I do think that's kind of what I'm interested in and what that means about us. And so some of it is that my writing comes from personal questions I have, like, how do I raise a daughter in this world? You know, and also I felt really strongly that if I was going to hold other women's lives up for examination, I better be willing to do the same to my own. So I've always you know, reflected on my own experience and how it fits in to what I believe or what I'm seeing or what other people are seeing. And I also make kind of the process of reporting really transparent, and I don't necessarily come to tidy conclusions. One reviewer said that it's like I turn my pockets inside out on the page, and I kind of liked that because I'm really interested in the reader as kind of a fellow traveler, not being like the authority.
So were there with you? Experiencing the dilemma or the debate or whatever?
Yeah, and when I hit a brick wall, I'll own it. I'll just, you know, say, and then this happened, and I don't know. I mean, you know, I could go this way, I could go this way, I could go up, I could go down, I could believe this, I could believe that. Where am I going to land, you know? Mm-hmm. Just like you.
Right, exactly. Just like you, the reader. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about then girls and sex. And and the first thing that I was struck by is that first you interviewed 70 young women, as I said at the beginning, ages 15 to 20. And you write in your book that at first you were worried that girls wouldn't discuss such a personal subject with you.
Yeah.
But in the end, you had more volunteers than you could even handle, and that they were hungry to talk to you. Tell us why you think that is. Why you thought one way, and then, wow, girls really wanted to disclose to you, reveal their experiences.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm now writing a book on boys, and I've been even more surprised to find the same is true with them. I really didn't think that would happen. I think it's because nobody asks, you know? I mean, I think we have there's so little discussion. On one hand, you know, kids are steeped in a really sexualized media that is telling them all the time, telling girls, you know, from the time they're little teeny, you know, being marketed to with princess toys and all that kind of stuff, that how they look is more important than who they are or how they feel. And that, you know, the most important thing is to be hot, the most important thing is to be sexy, the most important thing is to be desirable, not to understand your own desire. And then, on the other hand, there is no conversation with the trusted adults in their lives about these issues. So,
but you must have been trusting. I mean, you're not their parent, you're not their teacher or guidance counselor. So, I mean, it must have also been, Peggy, the way you asked the questions, the vulnerability that you presented to them as well.
I think to a degree, and I don't think it's unlike, frankly, the therapist relationship, except that I'm not trying to get them to, or you know, guide them to concluding something to make transformation in their lives, but although it often did. But,
right.
But, although I will admit that the first couple interviews I did, I completely bombed. And, I mean, they talked to me, for sure. They told me all kinds of stuff. But then when I had follow-up questions, these girls, this first couple girls, just ghosted. They would not respond. I would email, I would text, I would call, nothing. And when I talked to a third girl who knew the first two, I was talking to girls at one particular school, she said, well, of course they're not going to talk to you. You ask them about, like, you know, whether they enjoyed sex and, you know, these various questions. Like, no girl wants you to be, you know, asking them that. And I realized that I think the issue was that I was responding not with kind of openness and interest, but kind of with surprise and dismay.
Right. And they caught on to that. Yeah.
Yeah. They felt judged. And I had to learn how to, in this realm, I mean, I certainly knew how to do that when I was talking about other things, but in this realm too, to talk with a kind of openness and curiosity and listen in a non-judgmental way.
Absolutely.
And
I think that's what the book does too, in general, that it responds in a non-judgy, non-evaluative way. Now, let's talk about one of the things you mentioned just now about, you know, that girls learn that they need to project that sex appeal, that whatever they may be,
right,
a student, an athlete, a scientist, a politician, whatever they may be, they still learn that they need to project sex appeal.
Right.
What did the girl say that, you know, you concluded that, or that was a message?
Well, it's, you know, it's pretty clear everywhere. And I think what's most complicated about that message for girls today, as opposed to our generation, is that I think in our generation, we were kind of pushing back against that message. And now sexiness or, you know, being hot is really what it's reduced to, which is a really, you know, narrow and unimaginative and commodified idea of sexy or attractive. You know, it's not like beautiful. It's not like attractive. It's very commercial. And that is sold to them as really the form of personal empowerment. And that can be really confusing. So on one hand, you know, it's like they're supposedly expressing their sexuality or owning their sexuality. And on the other hand, that's all something that is projected and not anything that they feel in their actual bodies. So the purported confidence that they're expressing by, you know, trying to look like Kim or Nikki or Miley, whatever they're doing, you know, it comes off with their clothes.
Right. And that's such a mixed but powerful message in terms of how we see young girls.
And how they see themselves.
And how they see themselves as well. Now, you know, obviously I'm a parent, you're a parent of a daughter, I am too. You know, how do you think that we can change that as parents, or what can we teach our girls to change that message?
You know, I have to say that I don't know about you. How old is your daughter?
My daughter is 23, so she's older.
So I did not expect, and I think this has even changed in the 10 years between our daughters and 9 years between our daughters, that so much of my job as the parent of a contemporary child was going to be about managing media. You know, I mean, it is such a wall coming at your child of images and ideas, and trying to help them sort through that is so important, and making all these conversations really explicit. You know, I mean, my daughter and I, we talk so much about, I mean, to the, you know, obviously she sometimes is just like rolling her eyes and going, Mom, but I feel like I almost feel like if the media is going to brainwash her, I want to brainwash her first.
Right.
And I want every time she looks at that image for my voice to come into her head and say, you know, that's fake. This is why it's fake. This is what it's saying. This is what it's doing. This is what it wants from me. Mm-hmm. And we've been having those conversations, honestly, since she was 3, in a kind of 3-year-old way. But I think that we have to have, you know, we have to talk to our girls and our boys.
And our boys about
what messages we're getting.
Yeah, about the media, about the messages, but also,
about sex itself.
That they can come to us with questions. I mean, I went to my daughter very early as well and talked to her. And I've said this before in other programs, and I've written about this. You know, I asked her what sex was at a very early age. And she said, you know, you don't need to tell me anything, Mom. You know, Jason knows, my friend Jason told me what it is. And I said, well, you know, just tell me what you think it is. And she said, well, it's just when two people get in bed together. And I said, well, do they do anything? And she said, no. Are they undressed or clothed? Yes. And I said, well, you know, Jason's not right, but when you want to know the real answer, come to me. And she's like, oh, Mom, you always say that. Jason told me and he's right, you know? But I wanted her to realize that when she wanted, desired, or had questions, I'm there to be non-judgmental and non-evaluative, but there as well.
100%.
And it sounds like you're doing that as well.
Yeah, and one of the things that I talk about in the book is the example of Holland, and how there was research that compared 400 randomly selected girls from Holland in the U.S. who were demographically similar, college-aged women, and looking at their early experience with sex. And the Dutch girls basically had everything that we say we want for girls. You know, they were more likely to contracept. They were more likely to know their partners really well. They were more likely to be able to assert their wants and needs and limits. They were more likely to have a good time. You know, all the things that you hope for in an ethical sexual situation where they're asserting agency, all of that. And the American girls did not have that. They weren't, you know, the Dutch girls weren't drunk, various things. And when they talked to them, they said their doctors, teachers, and parents had talked to them from an early age, often about sex, pleasure, and the importance of a loving relationship, and that in particular, their parents had talked about, whereas American parents tended to talk only to their kids about danger and risk, Dutch parents talk about balancing responsibility and joy.
Wow.
And that's really a shift. And it, yeah, that kind of blew me away as a parent.
That is amazing. And that's that sort of hopeful picture that you talk about in terms of today's young women.
Yeah.
Is that the hope that we can talk about the joy and the pleasure and the good things about sex, not just the risks?
Yeah, because when we don't do that, we don't give them a sense of their ability to go into an physically intimate encounter, whether that's just kissing somebody or whether, you know, whatever they're doing in that encounter, and being able to have a voice and have, you know, expect reciprocity and expect ethical behavior and all of those things that, you know, that we want for them. If we silence girls in their bodies and keep information from them, it actually lowers their expectations of what they can want and deserve and expect in a relationship.
And then that's going to change their experience as well. It's going to change what they get into, who they get into with, have sex with, and what they experience. So I have to ask you then, Peggy, because, you know, it's in the news and this is right on this topic,
I know,
you know, as allegations of rape, abuse, harassment, and other forms of sexual misconduct mount against Harvey Weinstein. I know that you've written that every girl you spoke to, every single girl, regardless of her class, ethnicity, or sexual orientation, regardless of what she wore, regardless of her appearance, had been harassed in middle school, high school, college, or all three.
Yep.
And you say that we need to make changes in how we raise and educate our children. And so is this what you're talking about as well?
That's one piece of it. And I think, I mean, I now feel more urgency than ever in have it happening that I happen to decide now I need to write about boys, because I think a big piece of that, you know, one thing I hear a lot from the boys that I'm talking to, and they're, you know, they're boys, I think that boys, what I'm hearing is so much about vulnerability and confusion and a desire to connect, but an expectation that they won't. One thing they talk about a lot is the ways that in an encounter, particularly in a hookup, which is, you know, something that the hookup culture has really drifted into high school now, that what you're after is not a communicative, you know, complex encounter with another human. What you're after is status and a story to tell your friends. And I think that that's already a place of dehumanization that allows for a whole, you know, potential in some men, cascade of dehumanizing behavior that results in this kind of, you know, power trip.
Wow. First of all, that's so sad, you know, and I can feel it in my body as you were saying it. I also have a son who's 19, you know, in college. And so it's just so sad that we set them up.
Yeah, we do.
Instead of talking and educating and parenting in a different way. And like you said, it's conversations about social media. It's conversations about the media and the messages that are teaching our young people, whether they're girls or boys. Now, Peggy, we only have a few minutes left. I would love to talk to you for so much longer. There's so much here. Do you have any final comments about, you know, whether it's talking to girls or boys and what you want to share with listeners today?
I really do feel that we're at a moment that is so exciting, because as devastating as it is to hear all these stories, raw stories of women's experience that are happening on social media and are, you know, that have been kind of brought out by the Weinstein allegations, it also gives us this opportunity to stop and say, and look, you know, as well as looking at what happened to us, looking at how we can make things better for our kids and how we can think about raising our girls and our boys in a more empowered, connected, ethical way around sexuality and the way that we treat people in our physically intimate and our professional relationships.
Absolutely. That is wonderful how we can empower our children, both boys and girls, in terms of sexuality and relationships, whether it be at home, you know, at school or in the workplace. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Peggy. What a joy and honor to talk with you. I just wish we had more time. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. great fun. And listeners, if you want to connect with Peggy Ornstein, you can visit her website at peggyornstein.com. She's also on Twitter and Facebook at Peggy Ornstein, and her book, Girls and Sex, a wonderful read. And as always, thanks for listening. I appreciate you. I'm Dr. Terry, and this is the Love Doctor program on Empower Radio. I'm here to help your relationships be the best they can be. And my personal website is Dr. Terry, thelovedoctor.com, where I provide you with science-based relationship advice that's simple and easy to understand. So until next time, here's to your healthy, happy relationship.